On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We still don't know if the U.S. economy is out of the woods, but we do know who's in there with a chainsaw. Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Ben Bernanke has unleashed trillions with the Fed's unique power. First, to save the economy, then to try to bring it back. To save the banks, his critics say, to lock us into inflation, they say. He's done too much, he's done too little, saved us, doomed us. This hour On Point, sizing up Ben Bernanke and the revival of the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Are you glad he's there or had enough? Is Ben Bernanke saving our bacon or frying it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me today in the studio is Roger Lowenstein, economics journalist, author of The End of Wall Street. He wrote the cover story for this month's issue of The Atlantic, a really interesting study of Ben Bernanke's time as chairman of the Federal Reserve. It's called The Villain or The Hero, depending on which page you read. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Roger Lowenstein, thanks so much for being here today.
Tom, always good to be here.
Boy, Ben Bernanke is just right in the middle of all the talk again right now. Let's listen for just a second. Here was last summer, Roger. Everybody remembers this, but this was when Rick Perry just tore after him in Iowa in August, talking about Ben Bernanke and treason.
If this guy prints more money between now and the election, I don't know what y'all would do to him in Iowa, but we would treat him pretty ugly down in Texas. I mean, printing more money to play politics at this particular time in American history is almost treacherous or treasonous, in my opinion.
Almost treasonous. Perry himself got flack for that, but this is a Federal Reserve chairman who's drawn a lot of heat himself. He's been speaking out, as you know, Roger, this week. He was at the George Washington University. He's been giving a series of lectures there. He says the Fed prevented total meltdown. Looking back to the Great Depression here, he said we could have been there again if it wasn't for a strong response to the crisis of 08.
You know, the Great Depression was much worse than the recent recession, and I think the view is increasingly gaining acceptance that without the forceful policy response that stabilized the financial system in 2008 and early 2009, we could have had a much worse outcome in the economy.
Ben Bernanke this week saying it could have been a total meltdown. Here he is sitting right in the middle of everything, Roger.
Picking up on what then-candidate Perry said, I think he's dropped out of the race since, about him printing more money, one of the points of the piece is that was the purpose of the Fed. The Fed was created to provide a so-called elastic currency so that the supply of money could be expanded precisely in times like we've just been through, not to play politics, but you know, to get us out of the deep, deep woods with that chainsaw you referred to. And the main thrust of the piece is, look, as compared to when we were deep in the middle of the woods, 10.5% unemployment, banks failing left and right, we're doing okay now. And on balance, Ben Bernanke's the reason why.
Help us set up to understand this background. I mean, if you look at things right now and the critiques, and what's interesting here with Ben Bernanke is he gets harsh critiques from the left, harsh critiques from the right. You look at his performance kind of down the middle, but give us those critiques first so we can understand how embattled he's been in that kind of center position. What's the left critique? What's the right critique of this Fed chair?
The left critique is, look, let's just, go extreme opposite of Rick Perry, print all the money we can so that we have tremendous inflation, which means that everybody who's got a home loan, a mortgage they can't afford, suddenly the money's flying, they can pay it back. Of course, the money won't be worth anything. By the way, that would cripple the banks because they'd be paid back in money that wasn't worth anything. And we saw what happened when our banks are weak. But that's the left's critique.
And they're saying because that is part of the Fed's job to watch out for employment.
And watch out for employment. If McDonald's can raise the price of a hamburger to $8, it'll be much easier for them to hire workers at current wages and so on.
To be fair, they're not saying they want crippling inflation. They're saying they want a good dose of it to kind of boost employment.
That's right. But although people like Ken Rogoff at Harvard have used the figures 4 to 6%. And that's you know, for those of us who lived through the 1970s, you know, 4 to 6% is one stop along the way to 8 to 10%.
But they're saying, Ben, bring it on, because employment hurts. It's your job to watch out for it, and we want more, even if it means inflation. What about from the right?
Well, you just said the left said that's your job, employment. The Fed has two jobs,
right.
Statutorily two jobs. Mm-hmm. One is employment, and the other is to keep the power of the money stable, the value of the money stable.
Mm-hmm.
The right says, you know, any inflation is bad. Some of the right, by the way, says any paper dollars are bad, and they have a sort of a biblical view.
There's the Ron Paul view.
The Ron Paul view that if we don't go back to the Garden of Eden with only gold, bricks, you know, we're defiling the monetary system and defiling the country. And I think there is some of this view that anything the government does, it comes from this Tea Party view, anti-anything the government does, the Fed's part of the government, and therefore, you know, it's setting us up for the next problem. To flesh that out a little bit, maybe the Fed is papering over our current problems. Any remedy it does is preventing us from seeing our problems and will lead to the next round. And that's, I think, round of inflation. People won't realize that there's not the same demand for Treasury bonds because the Fed's buying them. That any intervention that the Fed, as a government agency, does, masks the true picture of the private sector economy. And I think spiritually or philosophically, that's where the right's criticism comes from.
It's a philosophical critique then from the right, with practical implications as they would see it. But it is also a real concern, which Ben Bernanke is hardly unaware of, as you describe it, of inflation here. I mean, he has put trillions into the economy, and that is a kind of baked in the cake risk here.
That's right. The banks now have an excess $1.5 trillion in reserves. If they were to go out and lend them all tomorrow, you know, back of the envelope calculation, the amount of money in circulation would triple. And so with the price of a hamburger and even, you know, gallon of gas and everything else. So it's the specific inflation critique is a real one, or the concern is a real one. And that's what animates people, you know, who are worried that Bernanke has done too much.
People are watching Ben Bernanke so closely. It's not surprising, but I mean, early this week when he made remarks saying we're going to hold this very low interest rate way out into 2014, and up went markets around the world like crazy. Bernanke bounce, they called it. Now, already, just in this week, we've seen that come back down to earth. But here he is right at the center of things. You describe Ben Bernanke's kind of two-stroke response to the crisis we've been in. And the first was to fend off another Great Depression, which looked like a real possibility. And the second is to really claw us back to growth. What's the kind of – is there a conventional assessment of how he's done on these two?
Tom, I think it's very useful to divide his responses in those two parts. So the first, again, bailouts to firms like Bear Stearns, AIG, Fannie and Freddie, although that was done by the Treasury, not by the Fed. The TARP program to loan money, to invest money in, you know, virtually every bank in the country. Those were things when the house was burning down, and that was just pulling out the biggest fire hose the Fed had.
But this wasn't all the Fed.
It wasn't all the Fed, but Bernanke was very involved, even parts that weren't technically the Fed, such as the TARP. Mm-hmm. He was a significant force lobbying for passage. So, you know, it's fair to say that was his program. That was to put out the fire. And the second part, and the assessment of that, you asked about the assessment. As much as people hate bailouts and they're still very controversial, I think most people would say that the bailout measures, the emergency measures, were successful. Maybe they weren't all fair. Maybe they could have been done better, et cetera, et cetera. But the crisis is over. We got out of the crisis.
So that's the evidence. They were successful because we're out of the crisis. Though, as you say, people are still concerned about lingering, unresolved issues around banking and how the system
but
is put together.
If you compare us with the Great Depression, if you compare us with Europe now,
Europe now,
you know, it's 2012 and things are a lot better than they were in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs are growing every month.
In the U.S. compared to Europe.
Banks are successful. So I think the conventional and the correct assessment of the bailout, far from perfect, it basically worked. And in the, you know, the fog of war, you probably can't ask much better. The second part is far more controversial. The second part of what he's done is to say, okay, we're out of the crisis, but what can we do to stimulate the economy so that it grows faster, so that it doesn't sink back into crisis, so that people who are unemployed get jobs more quickly, so that the housing market recovers? Because the housing market, unlike autos and steel and a lot of other sectors, has not come back. And that's far more controversial for a few reasons. One is people aren't sure it's the Fed's job to control the rate of growth. I mean, let the economy recover naturally.
In other words, it is their job to watch out for inflation, but not necessarily the GDP.
It's their job to get the economy to as high a sustainable GDP as they can within stable inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But once the crisis was over, Bernanke's critics would argue that the economy was on that course. And to say, hey, we're going to try to bail out the housing market, suddenly he's tipping the scales. Why should the Fed favor housing over steel? After all, that was a lot of what the government did before the crash. We had all these incentives for housing, and we ended up with far too many mortgages than the economy could support. So the other part of the critique is it's so hard to tell whether it's been successful or even effective. Would the economy have grown just as fast without his actions? Would it have grown faster, less slow? Since we can't rerun the film track, it's very hard to know what effect these various Bernanke-stimulated programs have had since the crisis.
But there are implications to those programs. He's making the case they're necessary. We're trying to pull the train here, get things going. But all that money is in circulation now, trillions, that the Fed has with QE1 and QE2 and all the rest.
It's either in circulation or it's parked in what are known as reserves, which are potential dollars for circulation, which means that banks now have greater reserves because the Fed has injected them into the system. And when people want loans, the banks will have more to loan. And that's how credit's created. That's how money's created. So there's a potential there for a lot more money to be injected into the system and for a lot of inflation.
Could mean growth. Could mean happy days are here again. Could mean an overshoot in inflation. There's a fear right there. And as you say, from the left, still a critique that not enough is being done to bring back jobs. Roger Lowenstein is with us today. His big piece in The Atlantic, well, they've headlined it the hero on the cover, the villain on the inside page, and people are all over the map on it. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Ben Bernanke, Fed Chair, is right at the heart of all the concern and speculation about the U.S. economy and the hope, too. You can join us today. How do you rate the Fed Chair's performance? How do you rate Bernanke on the rescue? How do you rate Bernanke on revival? And has he saved our bacon or put us on the road to inflation? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're sizing up Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke today and the rescue and revival, we hope, of the U.S. economy, looking at Bernanke's record, his way, and his fierce critics. Roger Lowenstein is with me, journalist and author of The End of Wall Street. He's got a big piece, great piece in The Atlantic right now, headlined The Villain or The Hero, depending which page you look at. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join the conversation today. Has Ben Bernanke saved our bacon or put us on the road to inflation? Did he save us from a Great Depression? Has he thrown too much money around? Too little? And do you know how much money the Fed has pumped into our system, our banks, in these past 4 years? Should it have been more to boost employment? And will it come back to bite us with rocketing prices? 800-423-8255 is our number this hour. 800-423-TALK. There has been a lot of criticism on the Republican campaign trail of Ben Bernanke. Here is Newt Gingrich. This was in November last year, saying Bernanke was the problem and firing him the solution.
Well, first of all, I think Ben Bernanke is a large part of the problem and ought to be fired as rapidly as possible. The Reserve ought to be audited, and we should have all the decision documents for 2008, 9, and 10 so we can understand who he bailed out, why he bailed them out, who he did not bail out, and why he did not bail them out. So I'm glad that Ben Bernanke recognizes some of the wreckage his policies have led to.
Newt Gingrich throwing stones in the storm there. Here was Ben Bernanke himself. This was on ABC's World News Wednesday night. Diane Sawyer repeatedly pressed the Fed chair on whether the financial crisis is finally over. Here's the classic, on the one hand, on the other hand, economists answer, the epitome of sort of cautiously optimistic.
The economy's been growing for almost 3 years, and we've had some good news lately. We've seen the unemployment rate come down. We've seen more jobs be created. And consumer and household and business sentiment have all improved. So that's all positive. But
strong?
We do have a long way to go. I would say that it's far too early to declare victory.
Too early to declare victory. Everybody can see that. Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people are watching closely on this front. Andrew in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on the air with Roger Lowenstein.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, well, I just want to know everyone's opinion on the growing school of thought that our entire monetary system and fractional banking at large is really just inherently set up to keep on perpetuating this recession cycle. And so though the American public might have it in their mind that we might be in a crisis or things are getting better and we should celebrate, we should demonize, or we should bless this guy. But really, you know, because of the way that the Federal Reserve is run, inflation is always going to happen. The economy is just a game of musical chairs, and that, you know, we all have short-term memories because this is a systemic problem.
Andrew, let us pick it up with Roger Lowenstein. He's looked so closely. And Roger, give us a little history here. There is a tough critique out there right now. Ron Paul never stops delivering it, a sort of fundamental structural critique. Why is the Fed there with this role? And what about the concern that the Fed itself is a structural problem within the U.S. economy?
Well, the Fed is there because we had a history, particularly in the latter part of the 19th century, of depressions, really severe depressions, virtually every 10 years, because we didn't have, when credit ran short, there was no backstop to come in. They would try to get J.P. Morgan to bail out the economy, the U.S. economy. I mean, the man, J.P. Morgan, got too big for even one very wealthy banker to bail it out. And to go to Andrew's point, the cyclicality in the economy isn't something that was invented with the Fed or with the current monetary system. It's almost a natural human phenomenon. Bankers get optimistic. You know, the economy starts to grow. They make more loans. They make more loans. And then ultimately they make too many loans, and we have a reversal. And that's been going on, that's as old as time. The purpose of the Fed is to modulate those cycles a little bit so that when we get too much optimism, there's someone who can pull on the brakes. And when we get, you know, too much depression, there's someone who can create some added liquidity and get us out of the mess. And it hasn't always been successful. Obviously, their first great test was the Great Depression, and the Fed failed, you know, very, very badly.
And Ben Bernanke's a student of the Great Depression. That's a big factor in his analysis now.
And exactly. And that was a lesson that he was so mindful of, and that's the example he's worked to avoid this time.
Ben Bernanke did not show up on the door of the Fed on the day that this current economic crisis started. He was there already behind Alan Greenspan. What about his culpability for the cycle that came to such a bust in 08?
Well, he was a governor of the Fed, as you say, before then. That's sort of like being one of the associate justices of the Supreme Court, and he certainly supported Greenspan's policy. That policy was very low interest rates, which helped to stimulate the mortgage bubble. He did not see the danger coming. And, really even worse for him, he did not see the exposure of banks, meaning banks such as, Citibank, for instance, which had these huge holdings of mortgages. And I say worse for him because his own scholarship on the Depression led to the view that you really get in trouble when big banks, big lenders, big agents in the financial system get overexposed and then can't make loans and gum up the works for the rest of us. And this very phenomenon was developing, and Bernanke missed it.
The Depression, 10,000 banks or something like that closed. That clearly on his mind as he was looking at this crisis.
Yeah, we had unemployment went up to 25%. You know, we had prices drop for two or three years in a row by 10%. So what, you played that tape of him on Diane Sawyer where he sort of hummed and hawed about, are we out of it? We are out of the financial crisis. But what he wants to avoid is sort of a 10-year semi-slump, almost what Japan went through, where although we're out of the house burning, we can't seem to get on track. And that's really what's preying on him right now.
We're going to hear in just a moment a tough critique from the right. We've heard it on tape here. We'll hear more of Ben Bernanke. But the left's critique has been tough, too, not only on saying, hey, let's loosen up some more here and create some jobs, but also on the Fed not pushing harder to get in with real restructuring of a financial system that seems to have been revealed as deeply flawed.
That's right. And I say in the piece that you can fairly accuse Bernanke of trying to reform the system, the banking system, but not trying to revolutionize it. He doesn't, he didn't believe in breaking up the big banks. He put through bailouts of banks that operated in a very flawed way. Bank of America is probably the best example. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. Ben Bernanke, for all his bailouts, is a very conservative man. He's not a flamethrower. He's not a revolutionary. I don't really understand the criticism of the left that he hasn't created enough inflation, that he hasn't done enough. He's brought unemployment down from 10.5%. The economy's growing. There's a risk of inflation as it is. And to say, he should be dropping barrels of money from the sky and doing more, you know, I think he has a sense of not wanting to go too far, and that criticism to me just is overboard.
But what about the criticism that there has not been enough structural reform in our financial system? How much of that responsibility sits with the Fed chair?
Probably not that much. I mean, he can lobby. You know, he's not the guy doing the legislation. You know, the Dodd-Frank legislation that passed the Volcker rule, but didn't go as far, obviously, as breaking up the big banks. Bernanke was, I would say, a cautionary voice in Congress. He's not someone to use his pulpit in the same way that Alan Greenspan used it, for instance. He more sticks to Fed policy. And, you know, it depends on your view. If you want to break up the big banks, then Ben Bernanke's not your guy. He's much more, going back to the model of the Depression, I think a Franklin Roosevelt New Deal-type model, reforming the system to save it, but not to tear it down.
There's been no shortage of apocalyptic voices in pulpits in this season of crisis. And of course, Ron Paul right at the fort. Here he is last October. This was at a Fox Business Network conversation. He's talking about shutting down the Federal Reserve and returning to the gold standard.
I don't think we can rescue the system and get it out of the hands of the Fed in time to save the calamity. I think their policies have been so damaging over these many, many decades that regardless, we are going to suffer from it. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. And if we don't get exactly what we want, I think we ought to really work hard on allowing a little bit of competition with this cartel who Right. runs the show, and they're the official counterfeiter.
The official counterfeiters. Roger Lowenstein is with us, got a big, great piece in The Atlantic. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Charles Calamiris joins us in just a moment. But first, to our listeners again, Paul in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have one comment and a question. First mm-hmm. comment is that the if you look at the core inflation, it's been much lower than normal. A lot of people look at headline inflation, but it's a lot more volatile. And if yep. you look at core inflation, it's been below the 2% mandate. So that's just the comment. And then my question is, during the Great Depression, you had monetary expansion under Roosevelt and continuing deflation. And as far as I can tell, there's no really explanations on the right that explain that phenomenon, that you have increasing money supply, yet at the same time decreasing prices. I was curious if your guest.
Paul, let us pick those two up. And first, Roger Lowenstein, to the fierce criticism about the risk of inflation. But as you report in your piece, if you look at his record over his time as Fed chair, he's got one of the lowest inflation records going.
That's right. It's the lowest record of any Fed chief of the five or so since the Vietnam War when sort of the landscape changed. So far, you know, Newt Gingrich says he's the most inflationary Fed chairman in history. And you really have to stand in your head to you know, try to understand that. The other comment, in the Great Depression, Milton Friedman, who is Ben Bernanke's mentor and you know perhaps idol and wrote the book on the monetary history of the United States, including the Depression, his thesis was that the Federal Reserve cut back on the money supply at several crucial times in 1931 and again in 1936-7 and didn't create enough money and at times cut back on the money supply. And that its reluctance to create enough money spurred what the caller talked about, that deflation, that fall in prices. So that's Friedman's explanation, and that's the accepted explanation.
Roger Lowenstein generally looks at Ben Bernanke's track record as Fed chair and says, look, he's been in a rough spot and done pretty well, especially well on in the actual crisis from saving us from a Great Depression. The jury's still out on reviving the U.S. economy. You can join us, 800-423-8255. With us right now from New York is Charles Calamiris, professor of financial institutions at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. He's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, member of all kinds of top economic boards around the country, and a big commentator on the role and function of the Fed. And Ben Bernanke, Charles Calamiris, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Great to be back.
You have followed Ben Bernanke for a long time and very closely since he's been in the top seat at the Fed. How do you end up grading him, rating him?
Well, it's a tough question for me. I've been a friend of Ben's for 30 years. I think he's one of the great economists of his generation. I supported his reappointment. I would say that it's been a really tough tenure for him as a chairman. So on sort of difficulty adjusted grading, mm-hmm. you might be able to give him a B minus. On non-difficulty adjusted grading, I would say worse. But you know, I actually prepared today. I went through because I knew I was going to be on your show, and I mm-hmm. went through and looked at the last 10 years of Fed policy and the last 5 years, and tried to come up with a way to think about what does a grade mean. And I would say there are four criteria that an economist should use for thinking about grading the Fed. One is the ability to adhere to and to articulate good rules and procedures for monetary policy. The second one is responding aggressively to crises. The third one is to stay within the appropriate actions of a central bank. He's not a fiscal official. He's not the Secretary of the Treasury. And the final fourth one is to exercise his responsibilities in overseeing financial institutions he's charged with correctly and, more broadly, the financial system. So I think if you think that those are the four criteria, I would say that
Hang on with that if you would, Charles. I have a feeling you're going to roll out his responses on those four. I have to say right here, we're looking at Ben Bernanke and sizing up how he's doing with the economy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. All right, Charles Calamaris in New York. So, you've laid out your grading structure. What do you say to
so
Mr.
that's
Bernanke?
My structure. And I think that the point is you can get to different overall grades for the chairman depending on what weights you attach to each of those. So if you want someone who's going to articulate rules and adhere to them, I think it's been uneven at best. If you want someone who's going to respond to crises aggressively, he gets an A grade for that. Appropriate actions of a central bank, I think there's some real questions about whether the fiscal actions of the Fed have been appropriate, and they have taken significant fiscal actions. And then finally, the oversight of the financial firms and the financial system, well, that's pretty much an F grade. Roger, I think, gave a very balanced presentation on your show so far. But clearly, you know, the failure to see things coming, the failure to correctly regulate Citibank and to make sure that it had adequate capital commensurate with its risk, we could go down a long list. So I think that the problem is if you want to attach a very high weight to responding aggressively to the crisis, you can give him a high grade. But if you apply sort of more even weights across the four criteria, I don't think he gets such a high grade.
Roger Lowenstein, what do you make of that critical assessment of Ben Bernanke?
First, I think, Charles, hi. Thanks for joining me.
Nice
I
to
think
see you.
The overall framework is pretty good. I don't have four rules of my own, but your four look sound pretty good. I think that in responding to a crisis, he certainly gets an A. I think in articulating a standard, I would give him an A2, you know, more than, say, if you compare him to Alan Greenspan, who was famously obscure. Bernanke has said, you know, I want an inflation target. I want to get employment back. He's told us what the inflation target is. He's been
much more out front in public.
Far more transparent mm-hmm. than anyone else. He certainly failed on regulation. But the important caveat is that most of the damage was done when he was either governor or not on the Fed. By the time he took over in February of 2006, you know, there was about a year to run of the mortgage cycle. Prices started turning down actually later in 2006. You know, realistically speaking, had the Fed turned on a dime, and it couldn't turn on a dime 6 months later and shut everything off, we would have had virtually the same crisis, I think. So, you know, as an economist, Bernanke does not get a good grade on that, but the damage was really done under Greenspan's watch. I really want to add one other criteria, mm-hmm. though, to that four-point set, which is, you know, step back. This is a, you know, academics and journalists like us can set up these metrics, but for the public, this guy took over in an incredible mess,
sure.
an incredible fog of war. Mm-hmm. Banks are failing left and right. And what's really important, I think, is not the average of these metrics, but did he respond to this crisis? Did he respond vigorously, sensibly, you know, the best that, given the fog of war, an imperfect economist could devise at the time, to the best that humans could do under such circumstances? I just think you have to give him a strong A on that part, and that's what really mattered to the guy in the street. He stepped up, and the other stuff, it sort of fades, you know, when the battle was joined, he was there. And I think that fifth criteria is the one that he'll be judged by history on.
Charles Calamaris, please stand by, New York. We'll come back and get your response on exactly that big point. Roger Lowenstein, who's just written for The Atlantic, Monthly, a terrific piece. You can find it at our website, onpointradio.org. We're talking this hour about Ben Bernanke, and you can join us. Has he saved our bacon or put us on the road to inflation? Does he deserve a medal for keeping us on our feet? Or all the brickbats, and there are plenty, coming his way. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are sizing up Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke this hour in the rescue and revival, we hope, of the U.S. economy, looking at Bernanke's record, his way, and his fierce critics. And they are fierce on the left, and they are fierce on the right. Roger Lowenstein is with us, a journalist, author of The End of Wall Street. His piece in The Atlantic this month is The Villain or the Hero, depending whether you look on the cover or inside. And that's kind of the way it rolls with Ben Bernanke. Charles Kalamiris is with us from New York at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business, economic, big thinker, big view, close to Ben Bernanke, but also a fierce critic himself in many ways. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Has he saved our bacon or put us on the road to inflation? Did he save us from a Great Depression? What about the structure, the economic structure that remains in place these years now after the financial meltdown that we saw? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ben Bernanke has spoken about the steps that were taken when it came to Wall Street and what could be done, what wasn't done. Here he is as part of his lecture series at George Washington University, saying bailing out institutions that were too big to fail, stuck in his craw, but had to be done and should not happen again.
What we had to do with Bear Stearns and AIG is obviously not a recipe for future crisis management. First of all, it was very difficult and in many ways distasteful intervention that we had to do to prevent the system from collapsing. And therefore, we chose the lesser of two evils and prevented AIG from failing. But that being said, going forward, we wanted to be sure that this never happens again.
Charles Kalamiris, you've just given him an F on oversight of financial institutions. He's saying we want to be sure it never happens again. That sounds like the right idea.
Yes. Well, I think also there's more to it than just the oversight mistake. You know, where Roger was talking earlier, I finally found something to disagree with him about, which is the management of the crisis was deeply flawed. And Ben Bernanke actually played a role in some of those mistakes. So I don't think we want to say that despite his good intentions and aggressive behavior and creativity, he still made some pretty big mistakes. Let me give you my list of five big ones. Mistake number one, Bear Stearns goes under in March 2008. Lehman goes under in September 2008. There's a lot of time. That's 6 months. Capital markets were open. The banks and the investment banks were not sufficiently pressured to raise capital. They did raise some capital, but not nearly enough, and the market value of their capital ratios was falling consistently over time. The Fed sat on its hands. The Fed was informed by MetLife that was thinking of acquiring Lehman in the summer of 2008, that Lehman was deeply insolvent, and they didn't take it seriously. So the Fed just sat on its hands for 6 months when it had the power and should have had the foresight to push much harder. Number two, when Paulson announced his terrible idea of this auction mechanism in September, October 2008. Bernanke supported it. I think behind
auction
closed
mechanism,
doors.
That was for what, Charles? Mm-hmm. The auction?
That was the first version of TARP. We have to remember TARP, there were three versions of TARP. The first two were such bad ideas that they didn't even happen. And Bernanke supported them and supported them quietly and nodded politely before all the congressional committees. And that was a huge mistake. And I think it also put the Fed into a deeply politicized position. And it was really, I think, a very bad idea. The third major mistake was after the crisis, pretty much, QE2. Now, I was a supporter of QE1. But the quantitative easing QE2 and also this another mistake, Operation Twist, just didn't have a good risk-return trade-off.
This is putting trillions ultimately into banks and the system.
For very little payoff. And I see them as a reflection of a deeply politicized Fed that wanted to pretend to do something but that actually didn't do much as a result. So I think that the risk-return trade-off just wasn't good. And then finally, the forward guidance that we've had in the last few months talking about trying to commit without really committing the Fed to low interest rates going forward, first till 2013, then through 2014. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to be clear about this. Charlie Evans, who's the president of the Chicago Fed and sort of the dove on the committee, has been pushing
on inflation,
for,
that is, versus hawks,
right,
who are tougher, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, frankly, I'm sympathetic. I'm not in support of his proposal for his so-called 7-3 rule. But what's interesting about his proposal is he's saying something that really would commit the Fed to an action. Instead, the FOMC's forward guidance statements are really not commitments, and they're sort of confusing, creating all this uncertainty. So, you know, my reaction to Roger's statement is, I actually don't think that the Fed has done such a great job on managing the crisis. I think that compared to a disaster, they did a great job, but there are other possible outcomes to be thinking about there. And those are my five sort of major criticisms of what they've done. And those are pretty important things.
I guess so. Let us pick up that thread of critique. Roger, what do you say?
Sure. On raising money, I agree that Bernanke was not very active. However, I think financial institutions...
Raising money, that is, asking banks to have more in the kitty.
Asking banks to get more liquidity in advance of a coming storm. Mm-hmm. Both after Bear and before Bear, they were under tremendous pressure from Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and they all raised, with the exception of Fannie and Freddie, what seemed like a lot of money. Nobody knew... what kind of storm was coming? It wasn't nearly enough. The problem they had was they had these assets. You know, Merrill finally sold off a whole bunch of its mortgage CDOs. They got 20 cents in the dollar for them. For every dollar they paid, they got 20 cents back. It was very tough for them to raise money. But I think the critique is fair. Paulson did what he did. Bernanke was not a big player in that. On TARP, I also agree that the first version of TARP, which was basically to have the government buy mortgage securities instead of having them invest in the banks, was flawed. But it was Bernanke, but they got to the right place, and it was Bernanke who had the initiative to say to Paulson, we can't keep ad-libbing this for AIG, not for Lehman.
Right.
We have to go get some kind of legislation. That was the big point. He was the one who said we have to get some policy, some legislation, and the legislation got to the right place.
Mm-hmm. What about forward guidance? Ben Bernanke's talking a lot about it. The market went way up. Markets around the world earlier this week when he said, well, through 2014, we're going to probably keep interest rates near zero.
First on QE2 to what Charles said.
Oh, yeah,
I agree, small return. I also think small risk. On Operation Twist, for instance, they're buying fewer short-term securities. They're buying more long-term securities. That's why the twist. I don't think there's much return from that. I don't think there's much risk in that. The forward guidance puzzles me. I think we're out of the realm of crisis management, which is what I was talking about, because it's 2012. When Ben Bernanke says rates are going to be near zero at the end of 2014, I doubt that. The economy is pretty strong. I think the Fed's going to feel the need to raise rates way before then. Way before then, Ben Bernanke's not even going to be the Fed chairman, so I don't know.
2014, he's earlier in that year, he's out. His time is up.
January, course, February, he's out. So how he can
say... A re-elected President Obama could bring him back again.
Yeah, it's unlikely. I think, assuming we're not back in a crisis, Bernanke's going to gladly go back to Princeton. So how he can predict even what'll be in the end of 2014 is beyond me, and I don't think the situation is that dire to say we're going to have 0% rates 3 years down the pike. But again, I don't think this falls in the realm of his crisis management. This is post-crisis.
Let me bring some listener perspective to bear here. I mean, we've got that back and forth on how he's doing, and we see you've got different perspectives. Charles is much tougher. Boy, you want to get tough. I mean, listen, here's one listener, Chris, who says, hey, everything's great aside from, and then the bullet points, tens of thousands of small businesses failing, over 25 million people unemployed or underemployed, millions of people thrown out of their homes, millions of people on food stamps and without any health insurance. Yeah, everything's fine for the criminal rich, Chris writes to us. And here's another at the website. Dave says, okay, here's the record. Debasing the dollar, monetizing national debt, synthetically inflating equities and commodities, not only providing safe harbor but enriching the robber bankers post-crisis. Nothing done to benefit Main Street and the economy as a whole. Fed has done one thing, expanded the gap between the haves and the many have-nots. History will not be kind, and writes, the people who were at fault for causing the economic crisis, they are all still in power. What do you say to that line, Roger?
I say that's a good question for Chuck, but for Charles. But I think the breadth of the criticisms in those two comments show you what Bernanke's up against. One of the commentators is worried about debasing the currency. The other, that people are getting thrown out of their homes. The other, that the gap between the rich and poor is growing. One has to note, first off, that the Federal Reserve isn't responsible for any of those things. And that I think because Bernanke has often in this period been the only adult.
The dollar has certainly responded to his policies.
The dollar, yes, but not directly. Mortgages that are written, at least not in non-Fed-regulated banks, not the gap between rich and poor. I think for much of this period, Bernanke has been the only adult in the room, certainly compared with Congress, and he's blamed for everything. The comment that people have lost their jobs, mm-hmm. The Fed's not directly responsible for that.
But employment is part of his writ.
The Fed can try to optimize conditions for people to create jobs, but the Fed doesn't own a steel mill. It doesn't...
But it's right there. One of its two major functions is to help make sure people get jobs.
We
have an economy that supports employment.
To create the right amount of money, to have mm-hmm. the right amount of money growth so that mm-hmm. businesses will form, so that mm-hmm. innovation will grow, and mm-hmm. so on. But the Fed doesn't have research labs. It doesn't have steel mills. It doesn't put out newspapers. So to think that Ben Bernanke can wave a wand, you know, is wanting too much and dreaming too much.
Let me get a caller right here, Rich in Trumbull, Connecticut. Rich, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Another comment. I think it goes, if you peel back the onion and you look at the underscore of this, it's like people like Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, he's involved in the bailout of Bear Stearns. If that firm failed, one of the people who loses first is J.P. Morgan Chase. So he's also saved by the bailout of Bear Stearns. So he graciously agrees to take over Bear Stearns if the Fed will put up $30 billion to cover his losses. What I find troubling is that Jamie Dimon sits on the board of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Excuse me. Tim Geithner, who is the president of the Federal Reserve and is now Treasury Secretary, as everybody knows, was bargaining with his own board member. So in terms of this deal, I find something very illegitimate about this. It's also the Fed, you know, they grabbed, who was it, Linda Robertson was the head lobbyist of Enron to push back against the congressional critics.
Let us pick it up, Rich. Our time grows short, but Charles Calamiris, what about this inside game critique of the Fed? And we've heard that a lot in these years of turmoil.
I think it's a reasonable point, but at the same time, I have to say I don't think that's those sorts of conflicts or conspiracies or concerns are really sort of on the top of my list. I mean, obviously, the people who are running the large financial institutions and who are running the Fed are going to be talking to each other, know each other, involved with each other. I'm more concerned and would be placing more blame on the Fed and the Treasury for one aspect of that deal, which is the shareholders of Bear Stearns got $10 a share. The Fed backstop could have been much smaller and perhaps non-existent if the Bear Stearns shareholders hadn't been given so much. So I think the idea that Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase had to end up with effectively a deal, and the deal somehow gave the Bear Stearns shareholders much more than it should.
Don't give them a deal. Give them a haircut, you could have said. I've got to say right here, we're looking at Ben Bernanke. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Charles, Roger, let me get to Ken in Pittsburgh. Ken, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Gentlemen, I have two questions. Roger, how will Chairman Bernanke take the liquidity out of the market? What tools does he have in order to compress this $1.5 trillion you spoke about?
That's a great question. This goes to the inflation question. And, Roger, as you write in The Atlantic, he has this unusual situation in Fed history of a really fractured board of governors behind him, people all over the place, and to an unprecedented extent.
Yeah, he's had a lot of dissents, but you know, right now I think the Fed's going to go where he wants it to go, despite the dissents. It's his Fed.
So how's he wringing it out of this liquidity out?
So the most traditional tool would be for him to soak up all the liquidity that he's created. Okay. All this cash that the Fed has been buying bonds, and he starts selling them, and the when people start selling bonds, you know what happens? Interest rates start going up, and the big risk is that Bernanke wakes up to find out that inflation's really roaring ahead, and he has to start really selling bonds. He's got $3 trillion on his balance sheet.
And then what happens?
And rates go sky high. And
interest rates across the board.
Across the board, mm-hmm. and he ends up snuffing out the recovery that he so methodically and gingerly
sounds like a significant risk at this point.
It is a significant risk. And, well, and
he has options. Pardon my interruption.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
He has options, but the problem is that some of those options don't look so good. So obviously a big problem too, Roger, is if he starts selling long-term treasuries or mortgage-backed securities, the realized capital losses on those, particularly as interest rates are rising, would be horrible publicity for the Fed.
Mm-hmm. Fed losing money on its big bet for the economy. Mm-hmm.
Well, and becoming insolvent. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't matter in any real economic sense, but it would matter politically. The other options the Fed has, it could increase interest paid on reserves to encourage banks not to lend those reserves.
Correct.
But that could also lead to a loss for the Fed. It could do what the Fed has argued it will do, which is large amounts of so-called reverse repos, which is sort of selling securities without really selling them legally. The question is whether the counterparties out there really exist to do $500 billion of those. I don't think so.
Charles, our time is short
So the last one is to increase the reserve requirement. And I've been arguing for that in a recent Wall Street Journal op-ed. The Fed should start to increase gradually and slowly reserve requirements so that it doesn't let the horse out of the barn.
He's got less than 2 years in his term right now. Early 2014, he's out unless reappointed. What do you think of the odds, Charles Calamiris, that Ben Bernanke leaves with the economy, flags flying and people settled down?
Oh, I think the economy's recovering. I think he's not going to get any big pats on the back from either party, unfortunately. He deserves some, but I don't think we're going to have flags flying. I think we'll have a continuing gradual recovery. We have a lot of long-term unemployment, and that's not going away quickly.
And Roger Lowenstein, you're pretty friendly on balance here. How do you think history is going to look at this guy who was part of the team as that took us into this crisis, but has been the one at the helm as we've tried to get out?
Tom, Alan Greenspan left a hero. He was celebrated, lionized, feted, et cetera. And then the crash left his reputation significantly in tatters. And I think on balance, Bernanke will witness through history the reverse of that. I think he's been the most criticized during his tenure Fed chairman in history. I think in time, history will look back and say, basically, this guy got the job done.
Will it really rely on the economy coming back, or is it economy coming back without inflation coming right on its heels in a bad way?
I think as long as the recovery doesn't sow the seeds of an immediate next debacle. As what happened with Greenspan, he got us out of the dot-com crash, and boom, we had the mortgage
housing.
We had the mortgage mess. If Bernanke can get us to level ground, I think history will look very kindly on it.
Ben Bernanke is still riding that tiger right now. Charles Calamiris at the Columbia University Graduate School of Business joining us today from New York. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Calamiris.
My pleasure.
And Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street and The Atlantic's big piece, The Villain or the Hero. Roger, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Tom and Charles, thanks very much.
This is On Point.